Pearl Church exists to express a sacred story and to extend a common table that animate life by love. A primary expression of our sacred story is the weekly sermon. If our sermons inspire you to ponder the sacred, to consider the mystery and love of God, and to live bountifully, would you consider supporting our work? You can donate easily and securely at our website, pearlchurch.org, or follow the link in the podcast notes. Thank you for partnering with us in expressing this sacred story.
Will you pray with me? God, this morning as we gather together, may we again open our eyes and see the wonder and beauty of this world and our connections with one another and with you that we discover in this life. In your name we pray, amen. You may be seated. Well, during this season of Lent, our community takes time to ponder the mystery of atonement. Atonement, in the midst of so many kinds of violence and division and strife in our world, in our nation, and within our very selves, we take time in our sacred story to ponder the mystery of all things being reconciled, brought together, to imagine what is divided being reconciled, what is violent giving way to peace, and what is broken being made whole. In particular, in this season, we are hoping to breathe life into some language to help us to name and to hold the pieces that need to be reconciled. The Christian tradition has this vocabulary, this language for suffering, words that for millennia have helped humans hold and seek restoration for what is broken. But language, all language, is susceptible of falling into disrepair. And these words that were once helpful can become all entwined with meanings that cause harm. For many of us at Pearl, the process of deconstructing violent versions of Christian faith has included consciously setting aside some of these words. Words like sin, or Satan, or idolatry, or death. While it's totally understandable that we need to set down language that causes harm, we can find ourselves bereft of words that point at these really important parts of being human. I mean, to name something well, you know there's this moment, maybe in therapy or with family or a partner or a trusted friend, when something gets named. And it's like putting your finger on a bruise, like you would rather not name it, but having language for the thing, it's painful, but also now it's hopeful because suddenly it's not ambiguous anymore. It's named and you have a way forward. That's what we're after in this language together, to reimagine this language that points towards something that just, it needs to be named. Words like sin, not the breaking of divine rules that keep us out of heaven for some reason, but rather all the ways that we participate in causing harm or that harm is caused toward us. We need a word that holds those experiences. Or the devil, which Mike talked about last week, not a dude in a red suit with horns and a pitchfork, but rather the reality of obstacles, adversaries, personal and systemic, which prevent our flourishing life. We need a word that holds those experiences. So we're working to reclaim some of this ancient Christian language, to breathe new understandings into it, so we can be articulate and present to the dynamics that cause suffering, violence, strife, and division in our lives. Today we're turning to the word idolatry. Throughout the Hebrew scriptures and the New Testament, idolatry is a really very real concern because the people of Israel and the early church are attempting to form this community around this distinctive idea of God, this God whose ways are increasingly distinct from the surrounding nations. And so the teachers and the prophets of Israel all the way through to Jesus are trying to to pull the people to this new way of thinking. And again in the Hebrew scriptures, the people keep turning back to the worship of Baal or Ashtaroth or other divinities. And in the New Testament, there's a lot of worry about eating food that's been sacrificed to idols and things like that. Now, these situations are not really problems for us today. I mean, when you go to Whole Foods, one of the choices, there are many choices you can make about your meat at Whole Foods. One of them you cannot make is whether it's been sacrificed to Jupiter or Mercury, right? GMO, organic, but not Jupiter, right? The Bible talks about idolatry a lot, though. Like, it's one of these words that comes up and again. And so in my evangelical upbringing, I think a reimagining took place. This idea that, this word is used so much, it should mean something for our lives. And so idolatry, as it was taught in my tradition, was about anything you might love more than God. Anything you might love more than God. So money could be an idol, or your work could be an idol. Or a new car could be an idol. Your boyfriend or your girlfriend could be an idol. Your hobbies could be an idol. Anything that was too important to you, more important than your relationship with God, was an idol. And I think for many evangelicals, this encouraged this weird stance where we were kind of afraid to love anything too much. I remember specifically fearing that if I loved anyone or anything too much, God would take them away from me, because God loved me and didn't want me to have idols. And so community and friendships and love and work, everything had to be held at a distance. And what I took away from this personally was it wasn't actually okay to be human, because to be human, to be here on this planet, in this body, is to love things, is to relish, is to delight. This threat of idolatry turned everything in my life against my relationship with God, as if loving my friends and loving my work and loving my home and my life were going to get in the way of loving God. Of this conception of idolatry, I think we can say good riddance. It bears bad fruit. It makes us imagine divine love as opposed to us enjoying and inhabiting our lives fully. This threat of idolatry discourages us from seeing our relationships or work or love or our whole life as the very place where we can encounter and know divine love. But as we say good riddance to that idea of idolatry, I think there's another concern about idolatry, which comes up through the biblical authors, which I think is worth paying attention to. Because when we think about idolatry as like loving your car too much, we miss a much more important issue, which concerns every one of us as humans. The ancient prohibition against idols in the Ten Commandments actually has to do with making an image, of putting any physical thing down and saying, that's God, or even, that's what God is like. This is what God is like. To be able to point at a statue or a painting or an icon and say, that's what God is like. That was a concern. The word idol comes from the Greek eidolon. The word eidolon means that which is seen or gazed upon, looked at. We get the word video from the same Greek root, eidolon. The idol presents the divine to us as something that can be totally known. Static, something that we can grasp in both senses of the word, right? We can take hold of it because it's physical, but we can also grasp it. We can get our minds around it. Something we can know, use, grab hold of. Now, this to me is a really fascinating insight into humanity for people to be making millennia ago, because this has to do at a certain level with our neurology. And we are about to take a really nerdy detour into neurology, and I'm so excited. Before we do, though, I want to play a video. I'm doing a little thing here, so just give me a second, and we'll bop around. Okay, I'm going to play a video for you. Some of you have seen this before. Okay, what we're going to do in this, we're going to be a little competition here, okay? We're going to have this side of the room against this. Actually, we're going to split you middle because this is we're a little top heavy this way. Okay, so like here-ish, over, and then all of you all, okay? And the job, he's going to ask you to do a task. And each half of the room, you're going to try and do that task better than the other half of the center of the room, okay? Okay, here we go.
This is a test of selective attention. Count how many times the players wearing white pass the basketball.
Okay, that's your job.
How many passes did you count?
11.
The correct answer is 15.
15 passes, okay?
But did you see the gorilla?
All right. Who saw the gorilla? All right. And who did not see the gorilla? Okay. So Ian McGilchrist, a medical doctor, psychiatrist, and researcher, has done extensive study and writing about the hemispheric nature of the brain. Now, you've probably heard terms like being right-brained or left-brained, and ideas like the left brain is rational, but the right brain is emotional, or the left brain is logical, while the right brain is creative, right? We've probably heard things like that. And to a large extent, those kind of popularized ideas are pretty false. But there is important difference between the two hemispheres of our brain, specifically how they attend or pay attention to the world. So McGilchrist argues that the hemispheric brain most likely evolved from the need of creatures to do two things at the same time. So imagine with me a bird or a dinosaur, your pick, okay? But it has to be one with their eyes on the kind of the sides of their heads, right? So when a bird is paying attention to something that it is trying to grasp or eat or get at, we see that birds will turn their right eyes, which are controlled by their left hemisphere, to look at something they're trying to do something with. But their left eyes, which are controlled by the right hemisphere, will stay attentive to the general horizon around them for predators, right? Because if you are a creature, you need to be able to do things, but you also need to stay attentive so you don't get snatched up in the meantime. So to make a complicated matter overly simple, our brains have developed two different ways of paying attention to the world, taking in and building up a sense of what's around us. The right hemisphere has a take on the world that is open-ended, fluid, relational, and nuanced, and tends to be receptive to what's unexpected. But the left hemisphere tends to see the world in abstractions, things that are fixed, mechanistic, and tries to force things into pre-existing categories. So looking through this here, with the left and the right hemisphere, for types of attention, the left is focused, detailed, and oriented, but the right is broad, open-minded, thinks about things more holistically as wholes. When it comes to processing style, the left is more analytic. It follows explicit rules. It loves rules even when the rules lead it astray. It will just follow those rules. But the right hemisphere is more intuitive and relational. Like, it will notice when the result the rules give you doesn't match up with the real world. The left hemisphere likes, when it comes to meaning, literal, fixed definitions. But the right hemisphere is okay with metaphor and nuance and even evolving meaning over time. The left hemisphere, when it comes to connecting to the world, tends to take a detached and objectifying stance. So every object around you becomes a thing to be used. Whereas the right hemisphere sees itself engaged in relationship and participation with the world around it. And then finally, when it comes to approach to knowledge, the left hemisphere is certainty-driven, seeks control, while the right is open-ended and embraces ambiguity. So those videos we played earlier, when you were given a task to do, the left hemisphere kicks in, and when a gorilla dances in the middle of the stage, it says, that's not relevant to the white players throwing the ball around. I don't need to see that. And it chucks it out. Similarly, you're watching a story, and you're trying to follow whodunit, and you're not noticing all the things that are rapidly changing around you. That's a left hemisphere take on the world. In my home, we've developed a helpful phrase. We call it task mode, and it mainly applies to me. When I am paying attention to Gary as my husband and I am attending to our relationship, I can be empathetic and patient and gentle and curious, and my richest enjoyment comes from knowing Gary more. But when I am doing a task, if Gary says to me anything of substance, I will not hear him. I will not. After about 30 seconds, I'll look up and I'll say, "Did you say something?" Now, the point of all this is that we have the capacity within us to attend to the world in different ways. And what we are able to see and what kinds of relational encounters we are able to have will be determined by the kind of attention we pay. If we attend with a left brain grasp, we will see reality as tools to use or obstacles to overcome. And everything gets reduced to categories we already possess. But if we attend with right brain awareness, we find a flow of mysterious and interrelated life with much that we cannot explain and that stretches us to rethink. And here's where we can return to that word, idol. The scriptures have a concern about representations of God because when we as humans move from a relational, open-ended, wondering stance, we begin to treat God, our relationships, or our environment as a thing to be grasped and used. We begin to attend to God with a left hemisphere attention. God is a thing to use that can be explained, that can be made explicit, and that works according to rules we already understand. And that kind of vision, I think we can name idolatrous. It turns us away from a right hemisphere vision, which allows mystery, wonder, and reverence, a vision capable of relating to what we could never grasp. This morning we read from Exodus 3 where Moses first encounters God at the burning bush in Sinai. And when asked for a name, God replies, "I am what I am," or better, "I will be what I will be." In other words, the divine will not be reduced to an object among others, something to be grasped and used and analyzed. John tells us that no one has seen God, but the life and death and resurrection of Jesus make God known. So what we have is not abstractions or principles about God, but a story, a life to observe, to relate to, always open to new understanding and revealing new depths of meaning. God remains ungraspable, unsayable, a mystery and a relationship. It's something like what writer Catherine May calls deep terrain. Deep terrain. In her book, Enchantment, May contrasts shallow terrain and deep terrain. She writes, "Shallow terrain has nothing under its surface. It's the same primary color all the way through. It has nothing to explore or investigate. Deep terrain offers multiplicity, forked paths, symbolic meaning. It will demand your knowledge, the kind of knowledge that comes with study. Know it, name it, and it will reward you only with more layers of detail, more frustrating revelations of your own ignorance. A deep terrain is a life's work." This is where I think this image of idolatry can be helpful to us. McGilchrist argues that we are living in a culture where the left hemisphere's mode of attention, abstraction, literalism, mechanism, manipulation, and control has become dominant. We live in a world stripped of mystery, where everything exists primarily to be categorized and then used, and nothing escapes the control of human purposes. And Western Christianity has participated, offering up a God in the shape of the left hemisphere. We write systematic theologies. We describe God's attributes. We cash out exactly what is going on the cross, and we say exactly what it is that you have to assent to in order to be saved. But I think this is an idolatrous vision. It is a vision that reduces the divine, this mystery, to a fixed and static thing that we can grasp. But to recall that we are placed into a world where our deepest and most essential relationship is to "I will be what I will be," to what can't be grasped or represented fully? Well, that is to put us back on the footing of how our right hemisphere more accurately knows our world. Relational, open-ended, awe and wonder and marvel at mystery that is beyond us. We are immersed in a world where things are not what we can grasp and use them for. Instead, we are immersed in relationally in a world that is grander than our hearts and minds could ever get around. I think this understanding of our hemispheric brains and the different stances of attention of which we're capable is really helpful in having compassion on ourselves. If you, like me, get stuck in task mode and find yourself missing out on relational opportunities or seeing God too much through the lens of ideas and beliefs and not mystery, well, that's a way that we are. It's not a bad thing. I mean, you need that left brain attention when you're trying to get a task done or stop at a red light or read a book. Like, it's important. But to believe that that is how the world is to miss the open-ended attention to God and our world that has always been at the heart of the healthiest and most vibrant kinds of Christian practice. I think this word idolatry can become a word for us that names how easily we can relate to everything from a detached standpoint. We can name idolatry when, as it's so easy to do, we begin to think of God as an object to have beliefs about, rather than the mystery of infinite love that upholds all things. We can name idolatry when we, as so easily we do, slip into seeing the people in our lives as either tools to get what we need or hindrances to our will, rather than living with them in dynamic interrelationship, open to the change and surprise and the adventure of relationship. We can name idolatry when we realize that we are seeing the earth itself and its teeming life in terms of resources, or as a background setting to human ambitions and goals and desires, rather than seeing ourselves embedded in interrelationship with a riotous environment of life with its own beauty and mysteries. It's not wrong to have the capacity to attend to things in order to use them. We have to, but we can remember this is not the only, and it's not the primary way to inhabit life. We can notice and return to wonder and awe, and return to the deep and never-ending life's work of coming to live in this place, to be here now, to know this place and these people and this love in which we find ourselves immersed. Will you pray with me? God, we pray as we sit here together in this room that we will become attentive to mystery, that we will become open to what cannot be said or defined, and that we will wonder and delight in all that is around us.
We hope that this sermon inspired you to ponder the sacred, to consider the mystery and love of God, and to live bountifully. If you don't already support our work, will you begin today? You can donate easily and securely at our website, pearlchurch.org, or follow the link in the podcast notes. Thank you for partnering with us in expressing this sacred story.